The deep dive is about to begin. I'm your guide, Janie Murdoch.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse.
Our mission today, to cut through the noise of this week's global source material. That includes the full issue of The Economist for the week of October 18th to 24th, 2025.
Right. We're here to really dig into it, extract the essential knowledge, and maybe find some surprising facts.
Exactly. We want to make sure you, the listener, are thoroughly informed on the really complex issues defining the end of 2025.
And there's a lot to cover. We're seeing this theme of accelerating disruption everywhere, from superpower trade to drug trafficking, even fiscal policy. It's a snapshot of a world just getting faster and, frankly, more complex.
That acceleration is so clear right from the start when we look at global tensions. They're not just military anymore, are they? They're deeply economic. We really need to begin with the U.S. and China. The sources are using this term normally for nuclear strategy, mutually assured disruption, MADI.
MD and trade. It captures it perfectly. What we're seeing isn't just about old school tariffs anymore. It's moved into weaponized regulation.
Like these new port fees, that seems like a very direct escalation.
It is a classic tit for tat, but with a twist. America went first, charging Chinese ships $50 per ton at U.S. ports.
Okay.
China's response, immediate and calculated. They hit back with 400 yuan, about $56 a ton. But here's the key part. They broaden the scope significantly.
How so?
It's not just hitting American ships. It applies to any ship controlled by a firm that's more than 25% American-owned. That's a much wider net.
Wow. Okay, so they're trying to track American capital globally, it sounds like.
Precisely. And they're signaling this isn't short-term. They plan to hike these fees over the next 3 years. It's building a framework.
A framework for economic coercion, as the sources put it.
Exactly. And it goes beyond just port fees. China's rolling out new strategic weapons, focusing on tech chokeholds. We're talking new export controls.
On what specifically?
High-performance batteries, critically, but also rare earths. This shifts the battleground from finished goods, like under tariffs, to the foundational materials themselves.
Rare earths. That's where it gets really complex with this long-arm reach they talk about.
That's the core of it. These aren't simple export bans. They're designed to inject maximum uncertainty into global manufacturing.
How does that work in practice, this licensing requirement?
Okay, imagine you're a manufacturer, say, in Germany, making advanced electronics.
Right.
Under these new rules, you'd need a license from Beijing to export your finished product if it contains even trace amounts of Chinese rare earths.
Wait, hang on. Trace amounts? What does that even mean for a complex supply chain?
It's almost an impossible standard. Think about high-end electronics, magnets for robotics, defense components. They all use rare earths.
So companies now have to somehow audit every tiny component?
Essentially, yes. You'd need to verify if, say, 0.1% of your product's value or physical makeup comes from a controlled Chinese mineral. That information might be proprietary to your own suppliers.
The uncertainty is the weapon.
Exactly. It forces companies to fundamentally rethink everything.
Yeah.
To potentially dismantle supply chains that took decades to build.
And that makes any kind of diplomatic olive branch almost meaningless, doesn't it, if this regulatory threat is always hanging there?
It completely undermines trust. Companies are inevitably pushed to diversify, to move production, even if it's less efficient. They just can't risk China pulling the rug out.
We're already seeing the fallout from this, right? The Nexperia case in the Netherlands.
A perfect example. Nexperia is, or was, a Dutch chip firm. The Dutch government just took control of it.
Why? What triggered that?
It was a direct consequence of U.S. actions. The U.S. blacklisted Nexperia's Chinese owner, Wingtech.
Ah, okay.
So the Dutch government looked at this and thought, hold on. If our key chip supplier suddenly can't deliver because its owner is sanctioned?
That's a major risk to our own economic security.
Precisely. A risk to critical infrastructure, domestic supply chains. It shows how the U.S.-China conflict forces allies into these really tough positions. Sovereignty versus security versus globalized ownership. It's a clash.
It really forces countries off the fence. Okay, let's pivot from that economic Cold War to a literal one, the Arctic.
Right, an area where the U.S. seems to be facing some pretty significant vulnerabilities.
And the focus isn't necessarily where the political noise is, like President Trump and Greenland.
No, the sources are clear. While Greenland gets headlines, the immediate tangible military threat is really around America's Pacific flank near Alaska.
And there are numbers to back that up.
Definitely. It's not just speculation. Look at this. Since 2020, 95 foreign military aircraft incursions into North American air defense zones. 91 of those, the vast majority, happened near Alaska.
91 out of 95, that's stark.
It really is. And these aren't just routine patrols. We're seeing joint Chinese and Russian Coast Guard exercises in the Bering Strait. Last year, nuclear-capable bombers testing response times. Highly provocative stuff.
And the U.S. ability to respond sounds stretched. What are the key weaknesses?
Well, there are a few big ones. First, the U.S. surface fleet, the Navy, largely avoids operating in the Arctic itself. That limits power projection.
Okay.
Second, and this is critical, icebreakers. The U.S. Coast Guard has only two heavy icebreakers that are functional. Russia, they have over 40.
40 versus two, that's a massive capability gap.
It severely limits year-round operations for the U.S. And third, the infrastructure is just lagging way behind.
The tyranny of distance up there.
Yeah.
Nome, the closest deep-water port to the Bering Strait,
is over 700 nautical miles away. That strait is a vital choke point, increasingly so with ice melt opening shipping lanes.
And 700 miles away creates huge logistical problems, especially for air defense.
A nightmare. Think about the fighter jets scrambling to intercept those incursions. They often have to fly 1,500 nautical miles or more, needing multiple aerial refuelings just to reach the planes and the identification zone.
1,500 miles, right? Just to get there.
To put that in perspective for you, imagine launching a jet from London to monitor air traffic off the coast of North Africa. It's that kind of distance. Hugely resource intensive for what should be routine.
That really paints a picture of the strategic handicap. So the answer has to be massive infrastructure investment.
It does. Years of spending. Rebuilding old Cold War bases like Adak and Shemya in the Aleutians. Expanding airports further north like Dead Horse. And crucially, upgrading the port at Nome for deep water military and commercial use year-round.
That sounds incredibly expensive and time-consuming. Not exactly glamorous work.
Foundational work, absolutely essential, but yeah, not flashy. And because it's such a huge undertaking, allies become critical.
How so?
Well, NATO expansion, especially bringing in Finland and Sweden, is vital for the Atlantic side of the Arctic, handling the Russian threat there.
Okay, that frees up U.S. resources.
Exactly. It allows the U.S. to focus its limited resources, money, ships, attention on the Pacific side. We're seeing practical examples, too, like the deal with Finland to help build new U.S. icebreakers.
Ally shoring for defense. Makes sense.
It's a necessary adaptation. Outsourcing some critical hardware needs new partners to speed things up.
It's clear that adaptation is the name of the game, whether it's trade routes or Arctic defense. Now, let's shift to a completely different kind of global network, one that seems to be innovating even faster than governments, the drug trade.
Ah, yes. The high-tech outsourced war on drugs. This is maybe the starkest example of decentralized networks outmaneuvering traditional centralized forces.
You mean the old model, the sort of Pablo Escobar top-down command structure?
It's basically obsolete, gone. It's been replaced by these fluid, incredibly resilient networks of specialist subcontractors.
Specialists? What kind of specialists are we talking about?
Highly compartmentalized. You've got expert chemists who just synthesize or mask the drugs. Logistics brokers managing incredibly complex global routes. Digital finance guys, often operating cross-border, handling the money laundering, usually with crypto.
So no single kingpin controls the whole chain.
Exactly. Hmm. Which makes the networks virtually impossible to decapitate. You take out one node, another subcontractor steps in.
And the engine driving all this innovation, this fragmentation, it's just pure profit, right? Hmm. The margins are insane.
Astronomical. Cocaine can fetch, what, 125 times its lab cost? But synthetic opioids like fentanyl, that's up to 1,000 times the cost.
1,000 times.
With margins like that, the R&D budget for evasion tech is practically unlimited.
Which leads to some pretty wild stuff, like these neutralizados methods mentioned in the sources. How do they work?
It's brilliant in a terrifying way. Applied chemistry designed to beat standard detection x-rays, test kits.
Ow!
They chemically mask the cocaine, dissolve it into things that seem totally harmless. Passion fruit pulp was one example. Or infusing it into recycled plastic, even dissolving it inside coconuts.
So it doesn't look, smell, or taste like cocaine.
Not until the process is reversed at the destination. And that takes specialized knowledge.
The logistics around that reversal sound like something out of a spy novel.
It highlights the value placed on human capital, on expertise.
Mm.
The chemist who created the neutralizado. They often fly, just like a regular business traveler, to the destination port, Rotterdam, Sydney, wherever.
To personally unmask the drugs.
They're the only ones who know the exact formula and process. It shows that the network values brains over just brute force.
And beyond the chemistry, the actual transport methods are evolving too. Narco subs.
The ultimate expression of this logistical innovation. They've seized about 240 over the last two decades, but the rate has shot up since 2018. Suggests mass production.
And these aren't just basic subs anymore.
No, they've evolved from semi-submersibles barely below the surface to genuine, fully submersible craft. Some can carry 10 tons of cocaine.
10 tons. Wow. And the really scary part.
They can now cross the Atlantic and the Pacific. And get this, none of the fully submersible ones have ever been captured at sea. They only find them if they run aground or sink.
Undetectable, basically. How are these shipments even coordinated across such vast distances?
High-tech tracking. GPS trackers on the individual drug packages. This builds trust and traceability between the subcontractors, the buyers and sellers who might never even meet.
It's like Amazon supply chain, but for illegal drugs.
Precisely. Outsourced, tracked digitally, using advanced logistics, just with lethal cargo.
And all this innovation isn't just aimed at the U.S. market anymore, is it?
That's a crucial shift. U.S. cocaine demand has kind of stabilized, partly because fentanyl is substituting it. But Europe, probably a bigger market than the U.S. now, consumption there jumped 60% in the decade before 2022.
And the biggest profits?
Way out in the Pacific. Australia. A kilo wholesale can go for $250,000 or more. That's a huge incentive for those trans-Pacific narco sub journeys. Also seeing growth in Asia, Latin America itself, it's truly global.
This resilience, this global spread, it makes the current U.S. approach seem pretty ineffective, the whole war on terror template.
Yeah, the sources are highly critical of that. The strategy is basically branding gangs as foreign terrorist organizations, FPOs, and using military force.
Like those Hellfire missile strikes on boats in the Caribbean.
Exactly. They killed 27 people in recent strikes off Venezuela. But the critique is that this kind of brute force just doesn't work against these decentralized adaptive networks.
Why not? Sounds tough.
It's high cost, low impact. Mostly political theater for the home audience. The reality, very little U.S.-bound drug traffic actually comes through the Caribbean now.
Where does it come from?
Most cocaine hits the Pacific coast, probably on those narco subs. Fentanyl. Almost all made in Mexico comes overland. So blowing up a few small boats in the Caribbean, it barely registers as a cost of doing business for the main players. They just absorb the loss, hire new guys.
So if military interdiction is futile, what's the alternative? What does work?
The focus needs a radical shift. Away from boots on the ground or missiles from the air, towards intelligence. Deep intel gathering, followed by legal prosecution.
Targeting who? Not the boat crews?
No. Targeting the most powerful, often invisible links, the financiers, the white-collar enablers, the lawyers, the logistics specialists, the money launderers, especially those cross-border Chinese groups using crypto and shell companies.
So financial warfare, essentially.
Precisely. These key figures worry about frozen bank accounts, sanctioned partners, legal troubles. They don't worry much about a drone strike scaring a boat crew. It's a job for specialized police, international prosecutors, financial investigators, not the military. Especially since the trade is often tangled up with corrupt local officials in weaker states, military action can just make things worse.
Fight complexity with sophistication, not just force. Okay, let's pivot again, this time to political volatility, starting with the U.S. footprint in Latin America. Things seem quite tense.
Venezuela is definitely a hotspot. Tensions really ratcheted up after Trump authorized covert CIA ops and publicly hinted at looking at options, even land strikes.
And those boat strikes off the coast? Officially counter-narcotics, but seen differently?
Widely seen as targeted harassment of the Maduro regime. Then you had US B-52 bombers flying pretty close to Caracas recently, within 150 miles. That's a very clear, very loud signal of potential escalation.
All this must be fueling opposition hopes that the regime is about to crumble.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
But diplomats quoted in the sources urge caution. They describe Maduro's regime as operating like a mafia, ruthless, focused on survival, maintaining tight control, very resilient.
So the U.S. actions create instability, but maybe without a clear path to actual regime change.
That seems to be the warning. It's a dangerous game, given the regime's proven ability to cling to power.
Meanwhile, further south in Argentina, the U.S. seems to be placing a massive bet on President Milei.
A huge bet, especially ahead of these critical midterm elections on October 26th. The support package is monumental.
What does it include?
A $20 billion currency swap line, direct buying of Argentine pesos to prop up the currency, and plans for another $20 billion private sector deal to help with debt payments. It shows how badly Washington wants to avoid the Peronists returning.
But this support isn't unconditional, is it? There's that quote from Trump.
Extremely conditional.
Yeah.
Tied directly to the election results. Trump apparently said, if he loses, we are not going to be generous with Argentina. That puts incredible pressure on Milei.
Creates a real cliff edge.
Absolutely. Milei's made progress on inflation, poverty, but he could lose ground to the Peronists. If he suffers a big setback, markets are terrified. Trump pulls the plug on that $40 billion plus lifeline. That could mean default, economic chaos. Everything hinges on a local election result.
High stakes indeed. And Bolivia is also facing a major political crossroads.
After 20 years of rule by the Movement to Socialism, MAS, yeah, they're heading for a runoff election. It's between a centrist, Paz, and a conservative former president, Quiroga.
And whoever wins inherits, well, a mess.
A devastating economic mess. A severe dollar shortage. The black market rate is almost double the official one. Inflation at 18%. Public debt at a staggering 92% of GDP.
So the new leader faces an awful choice.
A classic dilemma. Quiroga wants shock therapy. Go straight to the IMF for a loan, which means painful austerity, political backlash.
I'm Paz.
Promises a more gradual path tackling corruption, cutting subsidies slowly. But that risks looking indecisive, squandering political capital while the crisis deepens. Neither path is easy.
This level of instability isn't confined to Latin America. Let's look at Africa. We saw a coup in Madagascar recently.
October 12th. And it followed a familiar yet also modern pattern. It started with Gen Z protests, young people, digitally organized, out on the streets protesting poverty, corruption.
But the protests didn't lead to democratic change.
No. The military, specifically an elite unit called CAPESAT, stepped in and executed the coup. Colonel Randrina declared himself interim president, dissolved parliament, promised elections.
Within 2 years, a promise we've heard before in these situations.
And one that's often broken. It really highlights that dynamic. Youth protests can expose weakness, but ultimate power often still rests with the military, who could exploit the unrest.
And elsewhere in Cameroon, a different kind of political drama is unfolding.
Succession drama. The main opposition leader, Issa Tchiroma Bakary, has claimed victory against President Paul Biya.
Biya, he's been in power for how long?
43 years. He's 92 years old. This contested claim really throws a wrench into his plans to either extend his rule or handpick a successor. If the opposition, usually fragmented, actually rallies around Tchiroma, it could create a genuine crisis for the regime.
All these pressures, economic, political, military, they seem to boil down to systems under immense strain. Which brings us neatly to the looming fiscal reckoning in the rich world.
Yeah, the macro picture here is definitely concerning. Gross public debt in advanced economies is hovering near 110% of GDP.
And the sources put that number in historical context.
They do. Before the pandemic, we only saw debt levels like that after huge prolonged wars like the Napoleonic Wars. After that, Britain spent nearly a century running tight budgets to pay down the debt.
But that kind of fiscal discipline seems politically unthinkable today.
It seems incredibly difficult. You've got built-in spending pressures everywhere you look, higher interest payments on all that debt, rising defense spending because of global conflicts, and the big one, aging populations demanding more welfare, more pensions. That's almost irresistible electoral pressure.
So governments need to run primary surpluses just to stabilize the debt, meaning tax revenue has to cover all spending before interest payments.
Right. You need a healthy underlying budget just to tread water.
But raising taxes is political poison in many places, like the U.S., and cutting spending is just as hard. So if tightening the belt is off the table, how does this get resolved?
Well, the uncomfortable answer, hinted at quite strongly, is inflation.
Letting inflation erode the real value of the debt.
It's politically toxic in its own way, of course.
Yeah.
But historically, it's often been the path of least resistance compared to decades of austerity. Only Canada, back in the 90s, really managed a big debt reduction primarily through budget cuts. For most, inflation ends up doing a lot of the work, however unintentionally.
Okay, shifting from governments drowning in debt to warning signs on Wall Street, the first brands crash.
A $10 billion debacle. And the sources frame it as a necessary wake-up call about investor complacency.
What went wrong there? What were the red flags?
It seems like classic failure to spot danger signs, especially around something called receivables credit. That's basically money owed to the company by its customers.
And that's hard for outsiders to track.
Notoriously difficult to monitor and verify accurately. We saw this with the Greensill collapse a few years back that should have put everyone on high alert. Yet sophisticated investors, hedge funds, piled billions into first brands.
Why is tracking this kind of risk getting harder generally?
Because the financial system has changed so much since the 2007-09 crisis, risk isn't just sitting neatly on big bank balance sheets anymore.
It's hidden.
It's dispersed and obscured within complex structures, things like collateralized fund obligations, business development companies. Basically, these entities pool together risky, often illiquid private loans, and then sell slices of that pool to investors.
Making due diligence incredibly difficult.
Almost impossible sometimes. The underlying assets are private, the structures are layered. It creates opacity. The complexity itself becomes camouflage for the risk.
So maybe not a single bank run, but a system where nobody quite knows where the danger lies until something breaks?
That's the fear. The First Brands case showed lax lending, rubber-stamped by auditors and rating agencies. If supposedly savvy credit funds miss a $10 billion hole in receivables, it suggests the underlying checks and balances might be fundamentally broken right now. Complacency seems widespread.
And yet, despite these warnings, the U.S. deal economy is absolutely booming.
Yeah, we're in the eighth major merger wave.
Yeah.
Approaching record highs for those mega deals, over $10 billion, fueled by cheap capital, low borrowing costs, and of course, the promise of AI.
There's a strange paradox here with the Trump administration's approach, isn't there?
Very much so. Yeah. On one hand, a generally light touch on antitrust, which encourages consolidation. But on the other hand, using deals and things like tariff exemptions almost as political tools.
That Skydance Paramount deal example was striking, paying Trump's library to sort out a complaint.
Yeah, $16 million reportedly. It suggests a certain politicization of the deal-making environment. Getting approvals might involve more than just standard regulatory checks.
But the biggest concentration of risk in this boom might not be in those big public mergers.
No, the sources point deep inside the AI sector itself. These incredibly intricate financial webs being woven between the giants, NVIDIA, OpenAI, CoreWeave, AMD, they call them polyamorous relationships.
Cross holdings, massive investments, like NVIDIA putting $100 billion into OpenAI. What's the risk there?
Well, NVIDIA makes the chips everyone needs. By pouring money into OpenAI, its biggest customer, it essentially finances its own sales. It secures a huge guaranteed market.
Accelerates AI development, sure.
It creates enormous concentration risk. If NVIDIA stumbles, the whole ecosystem feels it. And these deals involve secret fine print, complex equity structures. There's a real risk of double counting assets or valuations across these interlinked companies.
So if the AI market hits a downturn,
the fallout could be much messier because of this circularity and complexity. Very similar to the hidden risks that blew up previous deal booms. History might not repeat, but it often rhymes.
A sobering thought. Okay, let's shift our focus across the Atlantic now to Britain. A spotlight on security, science, and some, well, unique social quirks. Starting with UK-China relations, the government's facing accusations of being too soft.
That's the charge. And it centers on two main issues that really highlight the contradictions in their approach. First, the saga over the planned new Chinese embassy.
The one at the old Royal Mint site in London.
That's the one. Huge potential embassy, China's largest overseas. But the major security concern is the location sits right over critical fiber optic cables serving the city of London.
So a massive security risk. But the government seemed to push it forward.
Well, the housing secretary, Angela Rayner, ultimately took over the decision, reportedly at China's request, overriding local concerns. This definitely fueled those soft on China accusations, prioritizing diplomacy or trade over security.
And the second flashpoint, the spy trial that collapsed.
Hugely embarrassing. Charges dropped against two people accused of spying for China because the prosecution relied on a really old law, the 1911 Official Secrets Act.
And the problem was,
they struggled to legally prove China was an enemy at the time the alleged spying happened. This, despite security officials simultaneously calling China the biggest state-based economic threat.
So a total contradiction between security assessments and the legal framework needed for prosecution.
Exactly. It shows the government trying to walk this tightrope, wanting a relationship with China, being less hawkish than the U.S., but then finding its legal tools inadequate when actual espionage concerns arise. Trade versus security playing out in court.
This tension between ambition and capability, it seems to echo in British science, too. The Whittle Laboratory example.
Right, a world-class jet engine research lab founded by the pioneer Sir Frank Whittle. It's crucial for UK aerospace future.
But it's underfunded by the state.
Specifically for the really high-risk moonshot research. It needs about £10 million a year for that speculative breakthrough work, but doesn't get it from government coffers. It's relying on philanthropy people like Lord Sainsbury and Peter Bennett stepped in to help fund even the new building.
Which suggests a kind of bureaucratic risk aversion.
That's the argument the lab's director, Professor Rob Miller, makes. He had that great quote, "If all the expert peer reviewers agree on an idea, we should not be doing it."
Meaning true innovation is inherently controversial.
Exactly. Disruptive ideas rarely achieve consensus early on. Bureaucracies tend to fund the safe bets, the incremental stuff, starving the potential game changers. Fear of failure stifles ambition.
And this difficulty in making bold, long-term decisions is compounded by the current political volatility in the UK.
Absolutely. The Labour government looks much less secure than you might think. Look at the carefully by-election in Wales.
A historically super safe Labour seat.
Held it since 1918. But because of political fragmentation, the rise of Reform UK on the right, Plaid Cymru nationalists on the left, Labour was projected to potentially come third.
Wow.
That kind of fragility makes any government terrified of making tough but necessary choices, whether it's on spending cuts, tax rises, or even science funding. They can't rely on their traditional base to stick with them through unpopular policies.
Okay, before we leave Britain, we have to touch on the quirky side, the Conquer Crisis.
Yes, a truly British phenomenon.
Yeah.
The World Conquer Championships are still going, but the source says the game itself, drinking a horse chestnut, putting it on a string, trying to smash your opponents, is all but extinct in schools.
Why? Health and safety.
Apparently so. Head teachers' unions say schools don't allow it anymore because, quote, it does genuinely hurt if you get rapped on the knuckles. A sign of a fading tradition, perhaps an overly cautious culture.
But on the other hand, Britain dominates. Giant vegetable growing.
Bizarrely, yes. They hold 18 of the 35 world records. Giant pumpkins, massive marrows.
Why are they so good at it?
A few reasons suggested. One, the climate, mild, wet, less plant stress. Two, a strong community culture among growers. They share specialized seeds and techniques at shows like the Malvern Autumn Show. It creates this positive feedback loop.
Okay.
And the third factor, according to a German competitor quoted, good old British eccentricity.
Just a love for the absurdly large.
Apparently. While others might focus purely on taste, there's a cultural embrace of the sheer oddity, the challenge of growing something enormous just because you can. Maybe it connects back to that high-risk, high-reward spirit the Whittle Lab needs, just in the garden shed.
From eccentric gardening to cutting-edge tech, let's talk autonomous driving, where China seems to be moving incredibly fast.
Astonishingly fast. The projections are stark. China's expected to have around 632,000 level 4 robotaxis fully autonomous on the roads by 2030.
And the U.S. projection?
Just 35,000. It's a massive gap.
Uh-huh.
And already, over half the new cars sold in China have level 2 driver assistance.
What's driving this China speed?
It really comes down to their regulatory approach. They use this test first, regulate later model.
Lots of local pilot schemes.
Exactly. They've approved over 32,000 kilometers of roads for testing. This lets them run myriad low-risk trials, work out the kinks, learn quickly, and then set the national rules. It cuts through red tape much faster than Western models often do.
But it's not all smooth sailing. They're also reacting to problems.
Oh, yes. They're learning as they go, and sometimes the hard way. After a fatal crash in Anhui this year, officials came down hard on automakers, warning them not to mislabel level 2 assistance as autonomous driving, fearing it misleads consumers.
And it was a big recall.
Xiaomi had to recall 117,000 of their SU7 cars due to system issues. So they're moving fast, yes, but also having to slam the brakes sometimes when serious risks emerge. It's a dynamic process.
Okay, from cars driving themselves to content creating itself, let's talk sloponomics. What is slop?
Slop is the term for this flood of uncanny, often low-effort, AI-generated content hitting every platform. AI videos from tools like Sora, AI written articles or book knockoffs, AI music tracks.
It's everywhere already.
And scaling rapidly. Spotify apparently removed 75 million spammy tracks recently. Just gives you a sense of the volume.
How does this tsunami of slop change the market? Who wins, who loses?
Well, the platform seemed to be winning, initially at least. It boosts user posting, keeps engagement metrics up. And crucially, it weakens the bargaining power of traditional big content creators.
Oh, so?
Look at music streaming. The share coming from the major record labels has dropped significantly, from 87% down to 71% since 2017. That space is being filled by independent creators, many using AI tools.
So the losers are the middle tier of professional creators, the ones who aren't superstars.
Exactly. They suddenly face competition from millions of AI-generated rivals, all fighting for the same attention, the same ad revenue scraps. It devalues human creative labor, potentially.
But the article suggests an opportunity here, too, especially for major rights holders like Disney.
Yes, a counterintuitive one, perhaps. Instead of fighting the slop, embrace it through licensing.
Licensing their characters and worlds for AI generation.
Right. Let users generate AI fan fiction, unique merchandise designs, put characters into new scenarios. The idea is this could actually boost engagement and discovery among superfans, maybe reaching new audiences.
A way to monetize the inevitable, basically.
And maybe learn from past mistakes, like how poorly the creative industries initially handled monetization in the early days of music streaming. If slop is happening anyway, find a way to get paid for it.
Fascinating. Okay, let's turn to our final section, looking at law, history, and some final insights, starting with the reality for judges in America today. Two Supreme Court memoirs paint a pretty grim picture.
They really do. Justices Kennedy and Barrett both describe this intense environment of political pressure and, frankly, physical threats. Barrett mentions death threats, lewd packages sent to her home, 395 judges threatened just this year.
And Kennedy recalls that chilling comment from Putin.
Yeah, back in 2001. Putin calling judges lions under the throne, powerful only as long as the state allows it. The implication being that if judges defy the executive, they risk losing that power, or worse.
A dynamic that feels disturbingly relevant now.
Very much so. The pressure from the executive, the public fury directed at judges, it suggests that view of law as just a political tool subordinate to power has gained traction within the U.S. context.
And yet, for all the discussion of this turmoil, the memoirs have a noticeable silence.
A very striking omission. Both books are full of implied criticisms about ethics, civility, constitutional boundaries being pushed. Kennedy laments the indecency in public discourse, links vulgarity to narcissism.
But they don't name names.
Yes.
Specifically, Donald Trump.
Studiously avoid direct criticism of him, even though he's central to the period and the pressures they describe. It's likely an attempt to appear impartial above the fray.
Though Kennedy's final thoughts seem quite pointed.
Absolutely. He ends one part warning that democracy can't depend on one person holding power too long. A clear, if veiled, rebuke against the kind of executive overreach and demagoguery he witnessed.
Okay, let's jump much further back in time. A discovery about lead poisoning and human evolution.
This is really fascinating stuff. Researchers looked at ancient hominin teeth and found surprisingly high lead levels, up to 50 parts per million.
From the environment, caves, streams.
That's the hypothesis. Constant low-level exposure from minerals dissolving into water sources. They then used brain organoids, lab-grown brain tissue, to test a theory.
Which was?
That a specific gene, NOVA1, evolved differently in modern humans compared to our ancestors or cousins like Neanderthals, and this modern human version provided tolerance to lead.
Why was that important? What did lead tolerance do?
In hominins with the older version of NOVA1, lead interfered directly with another crucial gene, FOXP2.
FOXP2, that's linked to language development.
Exactly. Vital for language learning, cognitive development. The theory is that the modern NOVA1 gene protected FOXP2 from lead interference. So Homo sapiens could develop complex language and cognition even with environmental lead exposure, while our cousins might have been hampered.
Potentially giving us a critical evolutionary edge.
A staggering thought, isn't it? Better tolerance to a common poison might have helped us outcompete Neanderthals and Denisovans. Nature finds unexpected pathways.
Truly amazing. Finally, let's touch on Ken Burns' new documentary on the American Revolution. It offers a different perspective.
A much grittier one. Described as a bloody epic of cruelty, rape, betrayal, and dispossession. Not the usual sanitized heroic tale.
Why is that perspective important now?
Well, it highlights things often overlooked, like the founder's deep, genuine fear of a demagogue, someone seeking power through sheer popularity. Hamilton's warning about someone mounting the hobby horse of popularity to cause chaos feels incredibly current.
And it also emphasizes what the soldiers were actually fighting for.
Yes. Not just territory, but abstractions. Ideas like liberty, representation. The film reminds us that even starving, freezing soldiers clung to those powerful ideals. It paints the revolution not as a finished historical event, but as an ongoing struggle over those founding principles and constitutional norms, relevant context for today's political visions.
So looking back across everything we've covered today, from China's economic weapons to the Arctic scramble, the narco networks, the debt crisis, there's this powerful theme of disruption and adaptation.
Absolutely. Every system seems to be straining. Organized crime adapts faster than law enforcement. Financial markets grapple with hidden risks. Governments face impossible fiscal choices. Everyone is trying or failing to keep up with accelerating change.
We saw how decentralization made drug trafficking so resilient, how AI slop is forcing media platforms to adapt or drown. The systems that seem to thrive are the ones that can decentralize, outsource, become more fluid.
That certainly seems to be a key takeaway. The rigid hierarchical models are struggling.
Which leads to a final thought for you, the listener. Considering all these insights, especially the success of those decentralized drug networks, or the way AI is distributing content creation, what non-technological institution in our world today do you think is most in need of a radical outsourcing or decentralization if it's going to survive the next decade?
That's a great question to ponder. Really gets to the heart of the adaptability challenge we've discussed. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us.
Always a pleasure. We'll be back next time for the next deep dive.